here can easily understand.
Just because it's late doesn't mean we're done yet.
I'm a server. That's a penalty.
I'm the quarterback. You kidding me, coach?
There's still plenty more hits to dish out.
Well, he really hit the shit out of that one, didn't he? Look at that. He hit the f***ing ball. Gotta get some free steak.
This is Late Hits. Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Presented by Dr. Ben Salento and Texas Sinus and Snoring. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
We are the only live, local, and consistent evening sports radio show in the city of Houston. Late Hits, ESPN 97.5. Patrick Creighton with you, 713-780-3776. 713-780-ESPN on the HRMP listener line, on the text line. On Twitter at PCreighton1. Aaron Ray Bolton on the side of the glass. The master controls at Aaron is blitzed at ESPN 97.5. And, of course, on the Twitch stream, twitch.tv/ESPN975. And guess who's 1-0, baby? You got that right. I'll tell you, the most amazing thing about last night's game is that for the first time in his 18-year career, Zach Greinke gets a win on opening day. Now, I want you to put this in perspective. 18 years. Zach Greinke in 18 years has won a Cy Young, has won 6 Gold Gloves, is a 6-time All-Star, has won 2 ERA titles. He is 209 and 126 in his career. That's a .624 winning percentage. Pretty darn good, especially when you consider he spent his early years on some bad Kansas City teams. .336 career ERA. Zach Greinke has a resume that will be discussed for the Hall of Fame. Even with all the injuries he's had, even with, you know, the bouts of anxiety that he used to deal with on a regular basis that he's worked really hard to overcome, he has something that is very close to a Hall of Fame resume. And almost 2,700 career strikeouts for Zach Greinke. He'll probably have 3,000 by the time it's said and done. And if he continues to just pitch the way he is right now, he's got a shot, a little outside shot, but a shot at 250 wins. And then take into consideration, you know, he basically lost 2/3 of a season because of COVID. And he still has a shot at 250 wins, 3,000 strikeouts. He has a resume worthy of discussion for the Hall of Fame. First time he's ever gotten a win on opening day. Now, for the Astros, man, old hat for them. 9 straight times the Astros have won on opening day. Since 1900, they are only the 5th team to have 9 straight wins on opening day. Mariners from 07 to 15. The Reds from 83 to 91. The Mets from 75 to 83, which is amazing because those Mets teams from 75 to 83, they stunk. Those are bad teams. That entire era of Mets baseball, literally from the trade of Tom Seaver to the arrival of Doc Gooden, those teams sucked. And the St. Louis Browns from 1937 to 1945. They are the only teams to ever win nine straight opening day games. Which is really amazing. By the way, for those of you who are curious, the St. Louis Browns later became the Baltimore Orioles. For those of you who are history buffs, and I know you all are. So Zach Greinke, first time he gets a win, and he looked great. Six innings, no runs, no walks. Three hits and four punch-outs, 82 pitches through six. Vintage Zach Greinke last night. Changing speeds, changing sides, changing planes. If you want to know what it is to watch a guy really be a craftsman as a pitcher, Zach Greinke is probably the best person in baseball to watch. He doesn't rely on overpowering stuff. I mean, he gets it up to 90, 91 now. It's like he threw hard. He doesn't even try to throw hard. A lot of times his changeup is as fast as his fastball. He just acts very differently. But watch the way he pitches as he moves the ball in, out, up, down, breaks it left, breaks it right, cuts this one, drops that one. Guys never know what's coming. He struck out a guy, I think, in the first inning last night on a fastball that was letter high after he threw him like four straight sliders. The guy is maybe the most cerebral pitcher in the game. All right, hitting his timing, Zach Greinke is the great disruptor. And you see how many times does he get that soft ground ball? He's got guys off balance. You get soft grounder. Greinke, five ground balls last night, seven weak fly balls. And I mean weak. You see fly balls and a guy like 30, 40 feet from the track. Straw had a couple of what you'd literally call can of corn catch. Stood exactly where he was, waiting for the ball to come down. So terrific outing from Zach Greinke last night. And he is the guy, look, he is the one guy on the roster that you could look at and say, Zach Greinke can give me 200 innings. He's the only one. And he went out and threw a gem yesterday against the Oakland Ass. And yes, they are the Oakland Ass. They are not the A's. They are the Ass. They're an ass franchise. They have ass fans. The whole damn city is ass.
He also went back to his favorite trick that he's picked up over the last half a season. Of the looking at a batter and going, you want two? You want the curve?
Let me give you the deuce.
Here goes. Here comes the curve. And he had a couple of batters go, oh, crap. Hold on. I need to. What the hell is this?
And he throws it.
Oh, and he does.
And they can't hit it.
Yeah. And they even joked about it at one point because he ended up close to the plate. And they said, you know what? You know what he said as he was walking back is, hey, curveball's coming your way. Try it. And literally. Like, within the next two pitches, curveball coming the way, swing and a miss.
You know, and this is...
He gets the mental game.
Last night, the Oakland Ass fans, all 10,436 of them in the stadium last night, which was the sellout because 20% capacity right now in California for outdoor events. The Ass fans really showed their ass last night when... They cheered when Astros hitters got hit. In the eighth inning, down 5-1, Adam Kolarik hit Jordan Alvarez with a pitch. The fans all cheered, and then the right away, Bob Melvin went out to go fetch him. So the fans are cheering that Jordan got hit. The guy's given up two home runs in the inning. And then he's walked a guy and hit a guy, and you're cheering. You're down 5-1 in the eighth, you idiots. And the manager came right out to go get him because he knew, I'm not letting this guy get freaking bombed. He's already been bombed twice. For the Oakland Ass fans who still want to, oh, you guys are a bunch of cheaters. Give back your rings, trash cans, bangers. Tell you what. You want the Astros to give back their rings, no problem. Lead by example, you first. Go find your 1989 rings. It's the last time you actually won a title. Go find your 1989 rings, shine them up, put them in a box, and give them back. Because you had the two biggest cheaters in baseball at the time. And Jose Canseco and Mark McGwire. The Juice Brothers. Those guys are roided out of their damn faces. That 89 Astros locker room is ground zero for the steroid era. Ground zero. You brought it in. That ass locker room, 1989. You basically ushered in an entire era of steroid use with your two best players. So tell me all about cheating. And don't try to tell me that, oh, well, stealing signs is so much worse than steroids. The federal government got involved in baseball because of steroids. Not ever have they gotten involved for any kind of sign stealing, which has been going on for 121 years. Federal government threatened baseball's antitrust exemption over not having a steroid test, not having significant punishment. So you tell me what's really worse. You want the Astros rings? Fine. You first. Hypocrites. Cowards. Jealous ass punks. Oh, we got the Moneyball team. Yeah, you got losers. That's what you got. Every year, you got losers. And last season, when you won the division in the regular season, and you're puffing your chests out and holding your heads high and talking all that junk about how, oh, it's your turn. You're better than the Astros. The Astros aren't any good. You're going to take them down in the playoffs. What happened? 4 games. Get out. That's what happened. Ass franchise, ass fan base, ass team, got put on your ass in the playoffs, got put on your ass last night. Guess what's going to happen tonight, bitches? Get more into this on the other side. First, got to tell you about our friends at MyBookie.ag. You know what? Nobody's got as much fun stuff as MyBookie.ag. I got a free winner from them yesterday. They had a bet. If anybody scored in the Dodgers-Rockies game, you won. That's it. Somebody had a score. Baseball doesn't have ties. It was a free win. Thanks, MyBookie.ag. I love free money. They've got every line, every over-under, every player bet, every team bet, every season bet. Oh, and they've got in-game live betting, so the action always rolls. All you have to do is sign up. Use promo code BET975, and you can get a first deposit bonus up to $1,000. $1,000 of free money to go bet and win more money. So go online, get there, hurry up. MyBookie.ag, use promo code BET975. Bet, win, and get paid. MyBookie.ag.
When it comes to sports betting, SportsMapBets.com is the site you need. From weekly betting guides to single game breakdowns of the point spread, money line, over under, and more, SportsMapBets has all the info you need to make the best play. SportsMapBets.com.
You're listening to Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Presented by Dr. Ben Salento and Texas Sinus and Snoring. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios. Here's Patrick Creighton.
All right, first things first, shout out to my man Fred Fowler, who was kind enough to leave us a little of this Eagle Rare Kentucky Bourbon Whiskey. Oh, that was good. That was really good. I love the bottle, too, but that was really good. I don't know where you got it, but next time you see it, grab me one, because that was very strong. I like that. Dan Lust is going to join us in the next segment. You know, I originally talked to Dan. I was like, hey, Dan, we're actually going to talk about something other than Deshaun. We were going to talk about the NCAA versus Alston case, and we are. And then literally, as I was talking to him today and just solidifying he was coming on at 7:30, 20 minutes later, HPD confirmed somebody has, basically filed a complaint against Deshaun Watson. So we'll get a little bit of Deshaun in, but we're going to get mostly into that NCAA case being held before the Supreme Court right now with Dan Lust in the next segment. Last night was, the Astros were in control, but the game really, the turning point of the game really is the bottom of the seventh, top of the eighth. Bottom of the seventh, Astros had taken Greinke out after six, and they brought in Anoli Paredes. And Paredes didn't have real good command, walked a pair of guys, also gave up a hit, gave up a run. Astros were not exactly playing their best defense. But with guys on needing to get out of the jam, Paredes, bottom of the seventh, escaping the jam.
Right here.
He got him. Anoli Paredes reacts, jumping off the mound after the strikeout.
So Paredes gets the big strikeout to end the seventh and keep it 3-1. Top of the eighth, and Unk unloads a laser.
He was Rod lacing one to second his last time up. This ball hit hard again. Michael Brantley, home run for the third straight opening day. Every year as an Astro, Michael Brantley has hit a home run. And the Astros have a three-run lead again. It's 4-1.
Uncle Mike with a screaming liner that was maybe 5 feet over the wall. That ball was hit like a damn laser beam. That made it 4-1. And then very next batter, Alex Bregman with a little back-to-back jack.
Alex Bregman on a 2-2 pitch. Drives one deep to left field. That ball's gone. Back-to-back jacks. Brantley and Bregman. And the Astros now lead 5-1.
That's right. Keep booing, ass fans. Watch those Astros round the bases. Thanks to our friends at AT&T Sportsnet Southwest with the audio. Bregman, Unk, back-to-back in the eighth. 5-1. Astros go on to win 8-1. And another cool thing from last night was Yordan Alvarez with a big oppo double that drove in the runs. Yordan had three ribs on the night. And to see him driving the ball, drove the ball really hard the other way. Had a sixth inning, two-run double, sack fly in the ninth. To see Alvarez, the power's still there. You know, he didn't get a whole lot of spring training at-bats. And even right now, Dusty has no idea what Alvarez is going to look like if he tries to slide into a base. Has no idea what Alvarez is going to look like trying to go first to third, second to home. Really has no idea what it's going to be first to home. Hasn't gotten to see him running like that in a game situation. So right now he is batting sixth. I would not expect Yordan to hit six for very long. If Yordan's healthy, he will be in the four hole probably by the beginning of May. They're basically easing him in. But if he's going to hit bombs and huge oppo doubles, he has the most power on the team. And realistically, he is, at the very least, one of their three best hitters. With just insane power to all fields. He'll be in the four hole as soon as Dusty trusts that his knees are going to hold. And realistically, you're probably flipping him with Tucker. So Tucker would go down to six. Alvarez would go up to four. Not that it's a demotion for Tucker, but Alvarez's power is just like otherworldly. That and, you know, Carlos Correa. Nobody has more on the line this year than Correa. Correa was 1-for-3. He also drew a walk. But nobody has more on the line than Correa does this year. If Correa has a big season, stays healthy, at least stays mostly healthy. If we're talking Carlos Correa plays 140 games, and he's got a 900 OPS and north of 25 homers, continues to play his elite level defense, Carlos Correa is going to get one of those 10-year, damn near $300 million type deals. That's going to happen. The Lindor deal changed everything. Because before the Lindor deal, it was, hey, you know, would 6-150, which is what Springer got, would 6-150 work? Maybe. As soon as the Mets offered Lindor $325 million, $150 million was never going to be in the discussion. And you heard Correa talk yesterday about how the Astros told him right off the bat, we're not doing a big contract. We're not doing a long contract. We don't believe in it, blah, blah, blah. Right now, Altuve's $150 million deal is still the biggest deal of the Jim Crane era. That's the high water mark, and they have no intentions of giving out another one. I mean, realistically, if this is how, I mean, think about it. They got McCullers on what I think is a very team-friendly deal. They can't get Correa on it. They weren't even going to try. Is it possible if Altuve has a strong season this year, they look to move him in the offseason? Is this the Astros' new financial model? Because after the last couple of years, it's probably fair to wonder if Altuve is in decline. And if he's in decline, you got four more years of $29 million, it's going to hurt. Again, not that they can't pay it, but it'll hurt. Plus, he's become a fan favorite. He's a, you know, the current like franchise icon. But if he has a big season, would they look to move him and escape that the rest of that contract so that they can use that money elsewhere and just pay less of it? But Corey Seager of the Dodgers is in line for a big payday. Trevor Story of the Rockies is in line for a big payday. Javi Baez of the Cubs, not quite on the same level, but in line for a big payday. Correa is the youngest of those four guys. Every one of those guys is going to get a big contract. the Astros decided to play wait and see, well, they waited themselves out of a deal. So I would expect Carlos Correa every night, big chip on the shoulder. We've seen this before. Guys with playing for that big contract have monster years. Don't be surprised if Carlos Correa has a huge year playing for that contract, because he's playing for $300 million. Talking with our buddy, noted sports law attorney Dan Lust, next.
ESPN 97.5. Please stand by.
Is Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Presented by Dr. Ben Salento and Texas Sinus and Snoring. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
All right, joining us right now on the HRMP guest line, from the law firm of Garrigus & Garrigus, he is the host of the Conduct Detrimental podcast, one of the super lawyers, rising star lawyers, noted sports law attorney that you have heard here on this show, on ESPN National, on Fox, on Sirius XM, on CBS, and basically everywhere, because he's the freaking man. It's our buddy Dan Lust. What's going on, Dan?
Pat, I'm good, and I had a feeling I was going to get the call. First, we had Austin, and then, maybe about an hour ago, we had some big Watson news, so yeah, I figured I'd be hearing from you. I'm always happy to get the call.
You know, funny, earlier, you know, we were texting earlier, and I said, hey, we're talking about Austin or Deshaun. I said, I will talk about Austin. There hasn't really been any new Deshaun news. And then literally like a half hour later, oh, look, Deshaun news. Like, we couldn't have a Friday without Deshaun news. It just couldn't happen. So let's start with that, Deshaun. HPD released a statement on social media today that there has been a complaint filed against Deshaun Watson. What is that mean in layman's terms, and does it have any, like, what do you see as the current impact of that?
So the wording was a little tricky, and you had to kind of piece through it, because when you have a civil case, they call that a complaint when a civil case is filed. So the police statement, Houston PD, basically phrased it as a criminal complainant filed a report. So a lot of people thought, hey, looks like the first criminal case has been started by HPD. So HPD can't start the case. That's got to come from the DA's office. But really all we have here is a fancy wording. Somebody filed a police report. Police report does not mean that a criminal case has been filed, but some individual, and we can impact, get into who that might be, but some individual went directly to HPD and gave them a criminal complaint and signed a statement. So my two cents, if you're asking me, we know that Tony Busby has some apparent conflict with the Houston Police Department. He's, I guess, saying, he has a conflict because he ran for mayor and HP doesn't like him. And he's worried about Rusty Harden's son being involved with HPD. So he said he wasn't going to deal with HPD. So you're asking me, I know Busby put out a statement. I think that this is a separate individual that is not affiliated with the Busby law firm, which would make whatever count we're at, something like number 22 or number 23. At least this one's hard to keep track, but I do think that this is someone separate from the Busby camp.
So Busby filed another civil suit today to bring it to 22. So this would potentially be 23, and then the SI girl would be 24, and then there's 18 that Rusty Harden has that says a good boy. So that's 42 Instagram girls for calendar year 2000. That's a pretty good number. That's a pretty high number. Now,
and I will also say there's a couple more. I remember at one point there were 24 accusers that the Busby firm was talking to. So it might be a couple more. But, yeah, we're getting close to 50, which is, I know people joke about it, but 50 separate masseuses, I'm not really sure. Obviously that doesn't raise by itself the issue of making someone culpable in a civil case, or obviously not a criminal case, but it's a question that is Houston jury, Harris County jury, they're going to want to have that answer. They're going to want to know that in the back of their head, why so many different masseuses? And No, truthfully, I don't know the answer to that, and that's a question that Rusty Hart is going to have to grapple with.
There's only 26. There's only 52 weeks in the year, and out of those 52 weeks, so far we're closing in on 50 girls, one a week. He's consistent. Now, how does this? This is a complaint has been filed. This is not the same as charges. This is just somebody has made a complaint now that the police have to investigate, right?
Yes, but there is something significant to it. So I was a little alarmed by Busby's statement earlier this week. He said, I'm not going to go to the Houston Police Department. You know, he basically said, stay tuned. I'm going to do something else. So that's his code, at least as I read it, of saying that my 21 accusers, my 21 clients are not going to be cooperating with the Houston Police Department because, for whatever reason, I don't really understand anything that Tony Busby does. I'm just being candid. I do not. But if you read the between the lines of the Houston PD statement, they were waiting. You can't have a criminal case without a cooperating witness. You can't do that. So HPD's last statement in this case is basically saying we have no incident report that's been filed, and we have no pending investigation because no one's filed a police report. So we can't start doing anything until we have someone cooperating. So this complaint coming forward is news. This is why Adam Schefter retweeted it. It's news because now they can open up a formal case, and now the case is somewhat kind of out of Tony Busby's clutches, right? He can't kind of dictate the pace of this case. Now the DA's office can choose to pick it up because they have a witness that I guess is working with them. I don't believe this person's affiliated with the Busby firm. It would be inconsistent with Busby's last statement. But, yeah, this is a separate track now from the criminal case.
Now, Dan,
I apologize, from the civil case, that is a separate track.
Dan, Rusty Harden said he welcomes this. Is this investigation, is this more in favor for Deshaun or for Busby? I mean, if the police decide there's nothing to charge, is that a feather in the cap for Deshaun?
No, this is not good for Deshaun Watson. So Rusty Harden, and, you know, you give the guy a lot of credit. He's dealing with the hand that he's been dealt. This is not good, right? This is, at best, right, how we're doing the numbers. At best, this is one of Busby's clients that has filed a criminal case, which isn't great. You know, maybe it's a number 23 or number 24. I don't know why this would be good news. I think Rusty Harden had to say something to try to do a little bit of damage control. But this isn't good. If the police don't pick up this case, right, we'll just call her Jane Doe for purposes just so we're clear. If they don't pick up Jane Doe's case, it doesn't really matter, right? They still might end up, a separate police department might pick up one of Busby's 21 clients. But here's the thing, right? There's 22, 23, 24, just however many there are. The police just need to pick up one of them to have criminal charges, right? This is not like a class action lawsuit where they're all going to rise and fall at the same time. The police can pick and choose which ones they want to file charges with. The issue is that Busby's not cooperating with the police, which leaves a little bit to be desired, but at least there seems to be someone that is outside of the Busby, the long arm of Busby's jurisdiction, and is now separately cooperating with the police.
Dan Lust, noted sports law attorney with the law firm of Garrigus & Garrigus, with us on the HRMP guest line. Dan, let's switch gears into this NCAA case, NCAA versus Alston case that is currently before the Supreme Court of the United States. Now, they heard arguments on Wednesday, and a lot of this was being tweeted out. Were we watching Supreme Court justices basically giving reprimand after reprimand to the NCAA?
It's pretty close to that scene from Game of Thrones with Cersei with the shame bell. It's pretty close. It's pretty close. This was a tongue-lashing. They really took their time. All nine justices, some justices that don't even normally ask questions, took their turn laying into the NCAA. So to read that the easy way, if you're a betting man, and say, listen, they're attacking the NCAA for a reason. This is them putting the, they want to kill the NCAA case, and they just want to make it a, public shaming. It's one way to read it, probably the majority way to read it. The other way to read it is, hey, they're just trying to make the NCAA sweat it out. But they took a case on appeal from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and they didn't take it just to affirm the status quo, right? Because Alston won. The players won at the first two levels. So not really that typical for them just to take a case up just to affirm exactly what happened. So there's a little view, a little part of this that you could be nervous that they might be trying to reverse the decision. So I don't know if we know the exact result yet, but if I'm a betting man, and Pat, you know I am, I'd say minus 250 in favor of the NCAA losing this.
You know, I was going to ask you about the idea of, you know, are they basically taking out the yardstick and slapping them on the hands publicly because, you know, when push comes to shove, they're going to give one of those rulings that, you know, whether it's for or against the NCAA isn't really going to hurt them much?
No, I think so. I mean, that's where the tides are going at this point. People want blood from the NCAA, right? So I don't think it's any coincidence that across the country and different state legislators, you know, paying college athletes is up for debate. It's up for debate in the federal legislature. I think maybe the Supreme Court just wanted their turn and their piece of the pie to be a part of history and changing the tones of college sports. This is it's a case about minutia, just so people are aware. It's not a case about, whether athletes should get, $50 million or $10 million. This is a case about whether college athletes should be able to get reimbursements on stuff like books and laptops. They should be able to get whatever externships they want to do in the summer, that they shouldn't be capped. It's a very minute issue. The issue of whether athletes will get paid, that's going to be up for debate in the legislative branch. It's a small issue. So whether Boston wins or the NCAA wins, it's not really going to change so much in the college level, but a win for the players would continue to be positive momentum. And you'd worry a little bit that a loss is just good case law on the books for the NCAA, and then maybe they start to get a little, a little confidence that they can, continue to maintain the status quo. So I think we want to win for Austin, but if they lose, you know, the truth is that the real battle is being fought in Congress right now.
Now, I know a lot of people, trying to follow along on the name, image, and likeness fight going on between the NCAA and players, but this is about compensation that they could get, like you said, for stuff that's academic-related. And if there's no limit on that, you're talking about they could basically you could get cash payments for academic achievements. And rich schools obviously can afford to pay more than not rich schools. But on for what this case is, we're talking about, like you said, reimbursements, book money, food money, internship money, internship travel money, that type of stuff. Not, hey, I'm going to go sign, 50 helmets and get paid.
Yeah, it's minutia. This really, it's not a, I'd say, put it this way. I think a lot of people were surprised that the Supreme Court took this case. And if you just listen to oral arguments, they didn't phrase this case about a case of minutia. These are some really big picture questions being asked. At one point, Judge Gorsuch went and said, you guys are making billions of dollars and you can't pay your athletes a couple thousand. So it seemed from the questions that they were trying to make a spectacle of this. And, and pre-COVID, we couldn't watch this live like I know a lot of people did. Law students across the country, lawyers were watching this. So there was a little bit of a spectacle that they made of it. But really big picture questions were being asked the NCAA. And then they said, if you pay college athletes, will it ruin the game? This really wasn't necessarily at debate for this case, but, it's a fun exercise. I'm sure these judges, they could be dealing with any number of things. But for someone like Justice Thomas, he says, hey, the premier programs in the country are Ohio State, Alabama, and Nebraska. That has nothing to do with the case, but, I think people wanted to have a little bit of fun with this. So, I think people sense the tides of college sports are changing. And credit to the Supreme Court for joining in on that. And I will say, Pat, U.S. Solicitor General got her say in here, and actually inserted argument on behalf of Austin, on behalf of the players. So that's kind of a wink and nod that, hey, the federal government is in support of players being paid, and, maybe it's a nod to Congress, to the federal government, hey, get your act together, let's get a federal bill so we're not fighting over which state can get their athletes paid first, and then having some really messy recruiting battles over Florida or California or whichever states can pay their athletes before other state legislators like mine over here in New York that still hasn't figured it out, which would be a really messy problem to recruiting.
Now, Dan, Justice Kagan had come up with the idea of the floodgate argument of, whatever the recourse of this case might be, how far does this go? And I think you're talking about the Solicitor General saying, well, that's not really your job to figure that out. That's Congress's job to figure that out. Your job is to figure out this, the right here and the now. Do you think that that is the attitude the Supreme Court will take, or do you think that they will look at how to set a precedent that will establish future policy?
Here's what you kind of have to keep in mind with the Supreme Court, and I've said it up and down. They don't take these cases lightly. If they take them, they're taking them for some reason. But the last time they talked about college sports in the Supreme Court was 37 years ago. And just so people are aware, you know, the NCAA lost that, but the NCAA was fighting to basically restrict TV networks to make it, you know, so you had that one showcase game like way back in the day. And the NCAA lost, fortunately, and now we have College Football Saturdays with the Big Ten Network and, you know, Pac-12, any number of networks. It opened up the floodgates because the NCAA was being overly restrictive of television rights. So I'm not sure what the Supreme Court's goal is here, but the last 37 years, almost 40 years, were controlled by dicta, which is a fancy way of just what judges were saying in the opinion. It controlled 40 years of college football and the development of college football. So maybe the judges just want their two cents in this, and maybe they're going to send a message to Congress and state legislators from the source of this opinion, because you know that all the legislators around the country were looking at this case. They're watching oral arguments to see how the judges handled it. So, yeah, I don't really think it's the judge's position to talk about the floodgate argument. And truthfully, I don't really buy it, right? Like, I put up these informal polls. If athletes get paid, how many of you would stop watching college sports? And, I don't know, 8% said they'd stop watching. So that argument of the floodgates, I don't really think anyone's buying. But, you know, I guess the judges have to say it. They have to entertain the position because the NCAA lawyer got put up on the stand and he made some type of argument. I think he's a little bit thrown to the wolves. They definitely went at him. Either way, it's a historic day for sports law, and I think it really does have the potential to shape college football, college basketball, all college sports for the next few decades.
Yeah, it is amazing how every case the NCAA always says, you're going to destroy college sports. Well, they lost the O'Bannon case. They lost the Board of Regents case. They lost the NCAA versus Law case. Yet the NCAA makes more money than ever and more people than ever watch college sports. At what point does, you know, the NCAA saying, you're going to destroy our sport, become sit down and shut up?
It's like the boy who cried wolf at a certain point. You can't keep saying, hey, if we lose, college football is going to die. And, oh, wait. College football keeps getting bigger, and we keep getting more fans, and our television contracts keep getting more lucrative. So, I mean, here's the catch-22. If the NCAA wins, and they win in some crazy fashion, and the Supreme Court oversteps their bounds, whatever the worst-case scenario would be, that would be really bad for college sports, because you have all these leagues starting to sprout up, be it that overtime basketball league where they're trying to pay high school athletes a couple grand, you have the G League paying athletes, you have the LaMelo Ball track going to Australia. If the NCAA wins and gets some draconian laws on the books, right, some draconian rulings, something really bad for, you know, student-athlete rights, student-athletes don't have to go to college, right? Like, so similar, right? If the players win, people are going to say, hey, let's go to college. We have free image and likeness. I can get paid money, be the big man on campus for 4 years, which, you know, I would hope we get back to some version of that. But, yeah, that's in play if Alston wins. So I think history is doomed to repeat itself. I think an NCAA win would be very bad for the NCAA, and quite the opposite is true. A loss, I think, is great for college football. It's great for college basketball. You know, I think player empowerment is fantastic, and I think that would make guys be more willing to suck it up and go to college instead of going, over to Australia or playing in some, dainty gym in the G League. I think if people want to play under the bright lights of college, they just want to get compensated for it.
He is Dan Luss, noted sports law attorney with Garrigus & Garrigus, host of the Conduct Detrimental podcast. If you want to know where sports and law collide, it's at the Conduct Detrimental podcast, and you should check that out. Follow him on Twitter at SportsLawLust. Dan, always a pleasure to catch up with you, my friend. We will talk soon.
Anytime, Pat.
All right, Dan Luss, Garrigus & Garrigus with us here on the HR&P guest line. And, you know, a couple of interesting, I guess, side effects to this NCAA versus Alston case. We'll get into it next.
ESPN 97.5.
We'll be right back after this break. You're listening to Late Hits on ESPN 97.5.
And on ESPN 92.5.
Presented by Dr. Ben Salento and Texas Sinus and Snoring. Live from the Veritex Community Bank Studios, here's Patrick Creighton.
Hey, join us for the Lucille's 1913 Inaugural Golf Tournament Monday, April 12th at Herman Park. Proceeds benefit nonprofit Lucille's 1913 and the Amani School. The tournament will be an 18-hole scramble with a 12 p.m. shotgun start. Food provided by Lucille's 1913, including those boxed lunches in the style of the individually packed meals that Lucille's 1913 creates for the community. Following the tournament, all golfers treated to a seated, socially distanced dinner on a one-of-a-kind stage set up as a hazard on the 18th fairway. Complimentary beverages provided throughout the tournament by Silver Eagle and Highway Vodka. Register now at Eventbrite.com. You know, one of the things about this NCAA case is the Supreme Court asking the NCAA, you know, hey, look, you guys basically have a monopoly. You don't have any competition. Why should we allow you to have that and then you get to determine what constitutes an amateur athlete and what doesn't? You know, you make up your own rules and you hold a monopoly. See, the NCAA not having competition, this is what LeVar Ball's JBL, like that JBL league, was supposed to be. It was supposed to be an actual competition, but LeVar never had the money to really be able to make a competitive league and pay enough players and pay enough coaches and travel and locations and facilities. He never had that kind of money to make a real league. And he couldn't get enough sponsors to put up the money. The NBA created this little G League program, you know, right where, like, on the Ignite team, they've got a handful of kids straight out of high school. But it's a handful. Now, a couple of those kids are top kids, right? Jalen Green was a top recruit who wound up going into the G League. Isaiah Todd was a top recruit who wound up going to the G League. Now, Jalen Green's contract is supposedly worth $700,000 with up to he could possibly get up to $1 million with incentives and endorsements and stuff. But he got $700,000 for what would have been his freshman year of high school. Well, freshman year of college, sorry. What would have been his freshman year of college, he got $700,000. Here is ultimately where the market needs to go. The NBA needs to get rid of the one and done. They need to get rid of the one and done, allow kids to go into the draft right out of high school. Make the draft four rounds instead of two. And make the G League a real minor league system where you can have 15 guys on the roster and develop players. Now your top guys can actually go right into the draft, get drafted, be dropped down to the G League, develop there for a couple of years before they come up to the main roster. Not everybody has to. Some gets ready to play right away. But the kids who aren't ready to play right away, that teams think these guys have a lot of potential, you can draft them in the third or fourth round and basically give them a G League contract and let them develop down there on your team. Every team should have their own G League affiliate that they run. So 30 NBA teams, it would be 30 G League teams. And each team should be run by its parent. And that will, you'll take the top talent out of college and right into the NBA, where you can put them with your coaches and teach them your philosophies and your offensive systems and your defensive systems and literally get them ready to be a part of your NBA roster. You know, look at LaMelo Ball. LaMelo Ball went to Australia. The Australian Basketball League, which is called the NBL, they have one roster spot allocated for each team that they can sign somebody from America. LaMelo Ball went and he was one of the best players in the Australian League, and he was 17. You know, you want to know why LaMelo Ball looks so damn good in the NBA? He's been playing against pros since he's 16 years old. Playing in Lithuania, playing in Australia. He's been playing against grown men. So to me, if the NCAA doesn't want to let anybody make any dollars, they're just going to keep losing the best players. And that's fine by me, because the NCAA is as crooked gets. All right, Major League Baseball actually took a stand and didn't trip all over itself for once. Get into it next.
I keep saying that I'm over.
Stay up to date with the latest innovations hitting the city of Houston by visiting innovationmap.com or follow them on any of your social media platforms. Just search Innovation Map.